Let's go to our biography segment. I so look forward to this. It's our week-by-week guide to New Zealanders you should know about. And today we're looking at the original good keen man, Barry Crump. He was a funny and carefree archetype of the New Zealand bloke in the 1970s and 80s, the lovable rogue with a deep, rumbly voice in a series of TV ads for the Toyota Hilux. We bought his books on deer culling and life in the bush, the pub. Loved his colourful male vernacular. But the truth about Crumpy was a bit more complicated. Colin Hogg wrote his biography. It's called A Life in Loose Strides, and that came out in 1999. And Colin's in our Wellington studio. Hi there.
Hi, Jesse.
Hey, thanks very much for taking some time out to do this, Colin. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I'm just glad that song finally finished.
Yeah, I was thinking about you down there, actually.
Sound like they were underwater. I sort of wished they were, you know.
I was thinking about you. Hey, can people still buy this book? Probably not, eh? You'd have to find it on Trade Me or something.
Yeah, I think it's in some library still.
Okay. And was it a monumental piece of work for you?
I sort of segued into it. I was editing a travel magazine in the early 90s, and I interviewed Crump, spent a day with him, and I'd never met him before, but I'd read his books when I was a kid and loved them, and wrote that story, and that sort of led, after he died, to the story being used in a tribute book to him, which led to a documentary about him, which led to a book about him.
When you met him, what did you each make of each other?
I don't think he liked me very much, because I didn't buy into the Crumpy thing, you know. He had this... He was an incredibly powerful personality. He was the biggest, you know, personality in every room or bar or whatever he was in, you know, and he was sort of naturally competitive. So, and I met him in a pub, and he proceeded to, you know, do that usual thing of trying to drink me under the table. Yeah, so...
He checked first who was paying for it, right?
He checked first who was paying for it, yep, yep, yeah. And he used to drink Johnny Walker Black Label with Elephant Beer Chasers, or I don't know which was chasing which, and after three you really didn't know, it was just a circle.
Wow.
So it was it made a great story, but he was such a bullshitter, you know. You sort of knew all the time it was an act, but at the same time it was such a compelling act, and he'd lived a lot of it too. He was one of those guys who became entrapped in his own personality to some extent, I think.
What do you mean it wasn't quite true? I mean, he did spend time in the bush, or he just came across as someone who might have?
No, he definitely spent time in the bush, but he gathered stories as he went, other people's stories, and yeah. I guess assimilated other people's experiences to some extent.
Right.
I mean, it's how he began writing, because he became friendly with a couple of guys who happened to be writers, Jack Lazenby and Kevin Ireland, out in the bush hunting. And, you know, he went to some parties with writers, and he was so competitive he decided he could write better than these people could. So, you know, he was a good storyteller.
You ever take a moment to think of what he would have made of life in 2019?
Oh, he would have thought he was on Mars or somewhere. I mean, he wasn't entirely what he seemed to be, this good, keen man thing, because he was also, later in life, he became Baha'i. You know, that's a sort of slightly mystical, reinvented Eastern religion that's still quite popular in New Zealand.
Yeah.
And, you know, he sort of turned against the Bushman label a bit, claimed he didn't like to kill animals anymore. And a lot of this was... reinvention, you know, changing the hue of the light on him a bit. There was a lot of that always going on. I always thought of him as a bit of a sort of carny, you know, a carnival man who just adjusted the act as he went. But it was a terrific act, and he did write some terrific books, and the books tend to get a bit forgotten in the middle of all the legend, you know.
Do I get the sense that you didn't like him very much?
Well, he was one of those guys you could like and really dislike at the same time, I suppose.
Okay.
I mean, I was drawn to him as a topic because I could see there was a terrible darkness behind all this blinding light that was coming out of him. And, You know, I knew things had happened in his life that were, you know, quite dark.
We might come back to that. And if anyone's listening who have their own stories about meeting Barry, text them through. 2101 is the text number. And for someone, and I was the same, we had a good keen man up at the batch, and I read that and then searched out all his other ones. But for people who have never come across him before, how would you describe him?
Well, he's slightly indescribable. I mean, he sort of lived the life, and he wrote about the life, and he was such a compelling writer and such a compelling raconteur. He sort of invented a kind of New Zealandness, I think, too. Mm. I mean, he was ahead of Fred Dagg and some of those other archetypes that we now love. You know, he invented a way of talking and a way of seeing ourselves and a sort of a sense of humour, too. But he was, he was a shocking misogynist. I mean, a lot of his early stuff is quite breathtaking when you read it now, you know, because the whole angle of all his stories was, you know, running away from two things, the big smoke and the old lady, basically. A lot of his stories just hung on that.
Which is what he did in his real life as well, right?
Yeah, yeah. But it's a sort of slightly dated concept now. I mean, if someone ran away to the bush now, they'd probably, you know, they'd hopefully be found in 2 days, but I'm not sure.
So maybe should we start with his childhood? Because it sounds, I was reading about it, it sounded pretty...
shocking.
Pretty grim, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
How did he grow up then?
Because when I started doing the documentary, you know, he'd been dead a couple of years, and I went off and interviewed, you know, his sister and brothers and lots of people, and sort of discovered this, the depth of this, you know, this childhood especially. He was born in South Auckland on a sort of, his father was a farm labourer and a very violent man who just terrorised the kids. I mean, extreme violence, and his wife. And Barry's mother was a, sort of took refuge in religion. And so Barry was sort of pulled between this incredibly violent father and this mother who hid behind God, I suppose. And the first moment he got, he ran away to the bush, lied about his age, and went deer stalking. And that's kind of where it all started, spent some years in the bush. And you know, came out, went to the parties in Auckland and Wellington, met some of these literary people and, you know, was encouraged to put some of his yarns down on paper.
His dad didn't like him very much.
His dad didn't seem to like anyone very much. I mean, some of the things that were done to those kids were tantamount to attempted murder, really. The stories are in my book, but it's, you know... late in life, Barry said his sister went to visit him sort of near the end of Barry's life, and Barry said something about he could never get the smell of the rubber from his father's gum boots out of his nose from when he was kicking him in the head. You know, things like that. It's
yeah, I think he'd think he broke his daughter's arm, right?
Yep, yep, yep.
Because she made too much noise with a knife and fork.
Yep, yeah. And you know, they didn't take her to hospital. They didn't want anyone to know, so it's a poor girl.
Okay.
Yeah. It was another time. I mean, well, it's not entirely because this sort of time is still going on, sadly, in New Zealand, but... you know, I mean, Barry was violent in his life, but I think it was always a relative thing to him. I think he always felt he was never as bad as his old man, and almost no one could be, I suppose.
Okay, and we'll come back to that as well. How did he get on when he started trying to write?
Well, he wrote what was the rough outline of a good keen man, and a very early version of it was actually printed in a literary magazine of the time called Mate.
Yeah, really?
Yeah,
great.
Yeah, yeah. you know, oh, it was that cool. Sort of literary joke. I don't quite know. Anyway, and it was a very stiff sort of story, and he sent this rough manuscript off to a few publishers who rejected it, but eventually Reed's, who were a big publisher at the time, saw something in it, and they had published previously sort of memoirs by old deer hunters and that sort of thing, and they found there was a bit of a market for it, and so they saw that in this book of the story of Barry's, but it was rough as guts, and they teamed him up with an editor, a guy called Alex Fry, who whipped the story into shape and sort of turned it into, you know, what it is with, you know, with Barry as the lead character out in the bush sort of experiencing all this for the first time. And, you know, it's a string of yarns. It's a great book. It's beautifully written. He had a touch of poetry about him, especially when it came to describing landscape, I think.
It just resonated in New Zealand, eh?
Oh, it really did. And also because, you know, he had this trick he did where he'd write in great detail about doing something that perhaps city people didn't know how to do anymore.
Yeah.
And he'd done it, so, and it was compelling, you know. And I think at the time too, I mean, this is 1960, most of New Zealand, city New Zealand, had come from the country, so there was this huge nostalgia for the old ways. But, you know, by the time Barry was writing about these old ways, they were already gone in a strange way, you know.
How many copies of that book were sold?
I think between that and the next one, Hang On A Minute, Mate, he sold nearly 500,000.
Yeah. Wow.
Over the years, you know.
Yeah. Must have done all right.
Yeah, he did. But he adjusted his lifestyle to, you know, spend all the money that came in. He was always chasing money. That time I went and interviewed him. After I interviewed him, I asked if he'd write a column for my magazine, and he agreed. And he wanted $1,000 for it, which is an awful lot of money at the time, but he was always short of cash. I think he gave a lot away. He didn't look like he had a lot of cash.
Got a text coming in from Mike on the Great Barrier who says, your book on Crump's a good read, gets off to a captivating start with the boots in all violence of his upbringing, and there's no wimping around in your book. That's a good compliment, isn't it?
Yeah, that's good.
Thanks again to the team from Ngātanga Sound and Vision, the Sound Archive, who have helped us out with this biography segment, and we've actually got Barry Crump describing his dad in an interview with broadcaster George Bellani. This was 10 years before he died. Barry Crump was 51 at the time.
Well, the old man was a bit shiftless. He didn't stay long anywhere, but where he was, did stay, he exhausted the scene. He was a man of great capacity, and he'd either hacked everybody else off around the place or he'd done everything that needed doing there, and we were shifting.
Yeah, and a fair bit of the old man rubbed off on Barry, eh? What was he like when it came to being a dad and a husband?
Well, it's the shooting through thing again. He didn't hang around. It was strange. He seemed to get on better with other people's children than he did with his own.
That's sad, isn't it?
Yeah. He's a bit of a sad case in lots of ways, but at the same time, he's a sort of golden boy, you know. Also, the other thing is he's sort of remembered as, you know, this crusty old guy that everyone remembers from the Toyota ads.
Yeah.
But really at the time he had his, you know, his the early days, the hit books, he was a young guy, you know. He was, he was never sort of good-looking or anything, but he was a compelling sort of a guy, and the ladies liked him, and he was another sort of thing altogether. He reinvented himself several times through his life.
Yeah, that sort of comes through in your writing, his impact on women. Well, women and men, actually, you say, but can you tell us a bit about that? They sort of fell for him.
Yeah, he'd sort of invade people with his personality. He was one of those guys, you know, you've interviewed a few so-called famous and celebrity-type people. Most of the time, you know, you want them to talk about themselves, but if you ever run into one who just puts all their energy into talking to you and asking you about you, it's quite an unsettling and a powerful thing to do, and it's what he used to do. And, you know, even years later, I interviewed old bushmates of his, and they spoke in his funny language. He had a slight made-up language thing he used to do, matey potatey and stuff like this, and these old guys were still talking like that. You know, he'd sort of... He could have been a cult leader. You know, he was invasive. I mean, in a sort of lovely way, but, you know, when he got bored, it wasn't maybe so lovely.
Yeah. Okay, I've got a couple of stories coming in now. They're quite similar to each other. I met Barry Crump once at the Barrytown Hotel. It was 9 a.m. I was dropping off some ham for the owner of the hotel. He was in the bar. I stopped and started talking to him. That was at 9 a.m. and I didn't leave until 8:30 p.m.
Yeah.
Night. Yeah, you can imagine how that went. I was building a lodge in Wanaka. when a helicopter landed right in the middle of a residential area out hot Barry Crump. Barry walked up to me with a crate of beer and a bottle of whiskey, and I said, I hear there's a party on here. So I said, there is now. They came in and left at 8 o'clock the following morning. That was John. Thank you.
Yep.
And how many wives did he have, Colin?
Five. Five.
Yeah. Who was the first?
Oh, Lord. Look, it's a long time ago, Jesse. I've forgotten. The last one was Maggie. There were five, but, I mean, there were other relationships as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, he wasn't long with most of them. He kept in touch with
Tina,
a lot
Anzo.
Of them. Yeah, Tina, that's right, yeah.
But, yeah, as you say, it was, according to your book, about a week before their first child was born, he started up with one of her friends.
Yeah, and he did overlap sometimes.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it was the night before he was to marry Fleur Adcock. He went off with a nurse or something, disappeared.
Here's what Barry Crump made of himself, or at least how he described himself. Again, this is him talking to George Bellani.
What do you describe yourself as, Barry? Are you an author or
a wanker? I'm just an ordinary rat bag. There's plenty wrong with me. And I just hope that, you know, others can handle what's wrong with them as well as I'm doing, or better, or, you know, really hard to say.
But whether you like it or not, you've become a cult figure, as I said at the beginning of the program, virtually in New Zealand. What's it like being a legend in your own time?
It's very hard to say, George. Very hard to say how much other people hurt, you know. But it carries with it, as anybody, Sharon Crosby, Tim Shadbolt, Sam Hunt, all of us will tell you the same things, you know, and if we were talking together, we'd all agree on exactly the same thing. It's a hell of a responsibility. And we're all louts, basically, and it would be much easier to get on with your own mistakes if you weren't subject to such scrutiny in that, you know.
It's Barry Crump discussing his own personality. I'm talking to Colin Hogg, who wrote a book about Barry, and as well as stories, and I was involved in a documentary too. Maggie on text, Colin says she met some ex-deer stalkers in the far south who were very resentful that Barry Crump had stolen their stories. Does that surprise you?
No, not at all. I mean, but, you know, that's par for the course in the business, really. You know, borrowing stories, adjusting them, making them better. He used to say there's three ways to tell a story. There's what happened, there's what could have happened, and there's what should have happened. And he went for the third one, you know. And that's okay. It's like folk music, isn't it? I mean, you just borrow bits and move it along.
Did he ever take one of your stories?
He almost did, actually, strangely enough. You know, I don't remember much of what was said that day I did that interview. It turned out to be quite a good interview, but I just didn't remember doing the interview with him, particularly afterwards. Luckily, I taped it. But I must have been taught. He said, what was I up to? And I told him a couple of stories I was chasing, and one of them was that I had this plan to book myself into an old folks' village for a week and write a story about it. And it never came off. I think I was going to do it for Metro. It never happened. And then when I was down interviewing Maggie, I think it was, for the doco or the book, I can't remember which, she gave me some of Barry's notebooks to have a look at, and we were driving away, and I was flicking through them, and the words "old folks' village" jumped out at me, and there was this paragraph about this journalist who was going to book himself into an old folks' village to write a story about it. So, you know,
yeah,
it goes around.
One of Barry's wives, says Hayden, wrote her own book about life in the bush as a bushwoman. Does that ring any bells?
Yeah, Robin. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Michael says a good keen man helped him to pass school certificate English. In fact, we heard from a couple of guys who said they had never read before they read A Good Keen Man. And he reckons that his father also wrote a book.
Yeah, his father did write a book.
McDonough done it.
Yeah, yeah. And then I think he tried to do a follow-up called McDonough won it. Oh, God. Yeah, the old man sort of tried to cash in on Barry's success when he was, a best-selling author and got bits and pieces of this rubbish printed, I think, in the 8 o'clock newspaper or something, you know. And I think maybe the first book, I think it was a vanity publication, I think he had it printed.
Guy says, Barry used to visit my father on his birthday, and each time he had a new flash American Finn car and a different beautiful blonde girlfriend. That won't surprise you. Michael says he thinks he went to a party at Barry Crump's house in Auckland City somewhere in the late 80s, and he remembers a tree growing up through the middle of the house. Did he imagine this?
Sounds like West Auckland, doesn't it?
It does. If anyone can confirm that, please do get in touch. Tell us about his relationship with Fleur Adcock, I suppose, being sensitive to the fact that I think Fleur is still around. She's occasionally interviewed here on... Oh, she's based in the UK. But anyway...
No, she's a wonderful and civilised woman, and, you know, she's spoken about him in the past. Mm-hmm. It's one of those things that I suppose has slightly haunted her, because they were only together for 5 months, and I think it was 1960, 61. I think he met her at a party, you know, part of the literary scene here in Wellington, and she'd been married to Alistair Campbell. And I actually think they got married just as a sort of shock event to shock their friends, because it was a complete disaster from the start. They were the absolute opposites of each other. You know, she's a very civilised, intellectual woman, and he's a rough broom.
You tell a good story about the wedding day.
Yeah, do I?
He was at the pub, apparently, and she dragged him out.
Yeah, and she had a black eye at the ceremony too. It was all just,
Maybe not a very good
story.
But
again, it was another, you know, it was that other time where people were just, oh, well, you know, God.
Yeah. That relationship with Fleur started a bit of a lifelong enmity with academics, I understand.
Yeah, well, Fleur was kind of... I think a lot of those young writers of the time were in love with Fleur, and they were very, very upset, some of them, when Barry married her. He'd stolen their princess, and there was a bit of a... Yeah, there were some quite nasty reviews of his book and put-downs and things like that, and I think it did hurt him a bit, you know. But it also spurred him on to write more books because, you know, the only way he could value himself, I suppose, was by how many books he sold and how much money he made.
He left New Zealand for a time.
Yeah, this very strange period in his life where he decided he needed to go and find God. And he went to India, to the Kashmir. But there's no witness to any of this. So, you know, when I did the doco and we couldn't, not, you know, no one had witnessed. He went to London first and Kevin Ireland was there, so he was seen there, and then he travelled over, like, bought a motorbike and went across Europe to India looking for God, supposedly. Spent, I don't know, 6 months or something there and came back and sort of started again. But he was a slightly different Barry after that. On the surface, he seemed to be a slightly different one. He wasn't quite the bushman anymore.
Hmm. And some time in Sydney too, I understand.
Yeah. The other thing to note about Barry is that he had this wonderful revival sort of halfway through his career with Wild Pork and Watercress, which I think, you know, is his masterpiece, really. That's the book that was used as a basis for the Wilder People movie that came out a few years ago.
Of course it was, yeah.
And, you know, that sort of picks up on that theme he had of the older guy and the younger sort of apprentice, you know, the kid learning. And you know, it's a beautiful book.
There were a couple of big moments or incidents in his life, Colin. Tell us about the Adventure Camp for Boys.
Yeah, well, in the 70s, you know, Barry had become a sort of brand, I suppose, to some extent, and someone got the idea of starting a sort of a bush camp for city kids where they could go and learn how bush skills and that sort of thing. And, you know, they got Barry and his mate George involved in it as you know, as Barry was the face of it, I suppose. And they set up a a camp down in a place called Teteko on the edge of the Urawiras. And City Kids went along and stayed, I think, for a week. And, you know, he supposedly showed them how to shoot and light a fire in the rain and all that sort of thing. But, you know, Barry was a bit of a loose unit and it was run pretty roughly. And one night there was a terrible accident occurred when Barry wasn't there and George wasn't there. And the boys were going out, I think, to do some spotlight shooting in an old Land Rover that had a broken handle on the back door. And it was one of those Land Rovers that was set up with gun racks behind the seats, so the back of it was like a cage. And there were five boys in there and a 14-year-old driving it, and it went off the road and went into the lake, and the boys drowned.
It's such a sad story, isn't it?
Yeah, terrible.
And what happened afterwards? Was there an inquest or something?
Yeah, I don't remember the details. Yeah, Barry and George were both charged with manslaughter and, you know, various diminishing sort of charges. It was eventually, I mean, he didn't go to jail or anything like that. It was, you know, it was seen for what it was, which was an accident, but it was an accident hugely contributed to by, you know, gross, well, carelessness doesn't get to it. Yeah, and again, that was quite a blow to him. He sort of took it on the chin at first, but, you know, I think it turned his life into sort of two halves in a way.
We better also mention the Toyota campaign, the Toyota Ute campaign, which is how many New Zealanders will remember Barry Crump. How did it come about?
He was living in West Auckland, probably in that house with the tree coming through it. And yeah. He was doing a radio show for Radio Pacific, I think, at the time. Didn't last very long, nothing he did. But he was driving into town past a Toyota car yard out west in Henderson or somewhere, and he saw this flash new Hiace, and he thought, oh, you know, I wonder if I could do something for them, give me one of those. So he pulled in to the place and talked to the manager, and the manager rang the manager in Auckland, and, you know, one thing led to another. And he did the first of those television ads.
Was Scotty involved from the start? I suppose he was.
Yeah. Scotty was the sort of, I can't remember how it started out, he was the sort of, you know, he was the soft city boy aspect, yeah. And Barry was showing him, you know, what this amazing car could do. And they were fantastic ads. They were hilarious, you know, larger than life. And they, you know, that's the Barry Crump that a lot of people probably remember, a slightly adjusted one.
Let's have a listen to that first ad in the series.
Hurry on, late Barry. Isn't she a beauty? Hilux four-wheel drive.
Looks okay.
You know why it's right, don't you? Because Hilux has...
Why is that, mate?
Because Hilux has got the experience and technology of Land Cruiser working for it. And it's tough.
Just hang on up here, mate. She gets a bit bumpy, eh?
Ow!
Well, duck down the window, mate. A bit of a shortcut we got. You're not married, are you?
No.
Oh, well, you're all right. Good track, eh? Just watch it up here, mate. The size of the snappers.
Tell me, Crumpy, how you been getting in here before now?
Well, there is one other way you can get in here. And that's it, right there. You take sugar, mate?
No, thanks.
Oh, well, just don't stir it.
Do you take sugar? No, don't stir it then. That's a great line.
Oh, is that line in the middle? You're not married, mate. Hey?
Yeah. I just had a quick Google, and the one I remember best is there with Lloyd Scott just sort of sitting there staring straight ahead with his face covered in mud. They also recorded a song called The Two of Us. We better have a bit of listen to that as well.
The two of us, we've been together 13 years, the two of us. Do you remember, Barry, the first time we met?
Cripes, you nearly leapt from the cab.
Yeah, well, I thought you were mad.
Could have seen yourself, mate.
It's just the two of us.
and we'll be always travelling on.
You reckon, do you?
Now stranger things have happened. And Hilux for 13 years has been number one.
I knew it was going to happen all along.
Did ya?
13 years at the top, and we're still going strong.
Yeah, that'll probably do it. Would have enjoyed the conversation when someone pitched that one to Barry Collin.
he could have done a Leonard Cohen song when you hear that voice,
yeah,
now, couldn't he?
True. He sounded like he was up for any sort of adventure. I just got a message actually from somebody who said that they're all coming in now. Goodness me. I met Barry Crump in the early 80s when I repaired his typewriter. He called me a wizard and told me a story about getting stoned with some staff at our public broadcaster's offices where he'd gone for an interview. That didn't happen at my interview, I've got to say. And somebody, now was there something involving an acid trip, Colin?
Yeah, it was when he was down in Wanaka. He'd get bored. He was quite interested in drugs. You know, he wasn't a druggie, but he was open to experiences. Anyway, he got up one day completely forgetting that he had an interview booked with the Woman's Weekly that day. They were coming out to his place and dropped some acid, and found himself out in the field, you know, as you do sometimes, hanging on to the wire fence, convinced that it was he who was actually holding the world together, and if he let go of this fence, the world would fly apart, at which point a car pulled up, and it was the Woman's Weekly reporter with the photographer in tow to do the interview, which Barry apparently managed to pull off while hanging onto the fence the whole time, thereby saving the world, I suppose. You know.
Mm-hmm. Grant texted in. He was actually at the funeral of one of those boys that you mentioned, and he said he sat in front of Barry, who was in tears most of the time during the funeral. Mm. That goes to what you said about the impact it had on him. And we've got one more clip, which I think is Barry dispensing advice. Anything you'd like to leave us with, Colin, about how he might be remembered?
Well, you know, the sad thing is his books are overlooked. It's just him. People should go back and read Wild Pork and Watercress. It's just a beautiful book.
Yeah. And he was awarded an MBE for services to literature. Thanks for your time today, Colin. Nice
pleasure
to chat to you, as always.
Pleasure.
Let's find another excuse to get you in soon. Colin's book is called A Life in Loose Strides, and thanks to the team at Ngā Taonga Sound and Vision for finding some of these audio cuts for us. We're going to finish with Barry Crump dispensing some wisdom on, I think this is one on teaching a bit of bushcraft.
It's a bloody good book, actually, George. It's about an old guy and a young guy who don't get on very well with everybody. And they take to the Urawera bush up here in the central North Island to see if they can hang on at least a while till the boy's 15 and he won't be subject to social welfare pressures. But he was just getting himself more into trouble all the time. And what happens, the book's about what happens to them and they're trying to survive in that situation and how they get on with each other, you know. I really think it's a... I've put the most into it for the reader that of anything I've ever done. And in doing that, I learned how to write books.